Hi, everybody, and welcome to an Alan Smithy podcast. My name is Matt, and I write at cinemachine.blogspot.com.
And I'm Andrew, and I write at thestopbutton.com.
And this is our podcast where we talk about one good movie and one bad movie for about 1 hour. We also do commentary tracks, and we are gradually phasing into sort of all commentary format. But we still got some double features left that we want to do, and one that we have talked about for a while has been Carrie and Carrie 2, or The Rage, Carrie 2. And this just seemed like such a natural pairing of a good movie, bad movie, because well, it's you've got something that's regarded as kind of a classic horror movie from the 70s, and then you've got a sequel that was made over 23 years later.
23 years later,
which is a really long amount of time. I mean, what, Psycho 2 came out after Psycho 1, 22 years, but that was between 1960 and 1983. The problem with Carrie 2 is that it came out like in that dead zone of time between when remakes were considered socially acceptable and when the horror genre was kind of in, you know, a little bit of a postmodern resurgence thanks to Scream. But it didn't mean that they were going to be remaking all these old movies. It just meant that, like, you know, in the case of Carrie or Halloween, for example, which there actually are some parallels between the two, they would just make a sequel, even though it was however much time left. And, well, it's not as though they got Sissy Spacek back for Carrie 2. I mean, that could have made it interesting. But Carrie 2 is like a remake in everything but, you know, contrivance. But let's not talk about Carrie 2 first. Let's talk about Carrie 1 first. And the other reason I wanted to do this double feature with you was because I've never seen Carrie before, and you hadn't either, right?
Right, yeah.
And, you know, I've always heard nothing but good things. And, you know, I know I've said this before on the podcast, but this is one of those movies where I have just seen it referenced and parodied in so many different media, and that you feel like you've seen the movie without ever having seen it. So, you know, okay, sure, it would have been a stronger movie if I didn't know what was coming, but the highest compliment that I can pay to it, because I really did enjoy it, was that even with all the, you know, with however many years of hearing about, you know, how good a horror movie Carrie was, Carrie really is a great movie. I don't know if it's the best horror movie, but just as a movie, it's excellent. And also, it's not it lives up to its own hype, you know, just put it that way, nice and simple. Here's something else. It wasn't really what I was expecting. Even I kind of disregarded the fact that, like, you know, the 70s was when Brian De Palma, you know, kind of first arrived on the scene, and it's the height of his, you know, over the top stylishness. And
right.
It's, you know, that's, Carrie's got over the top stylishness in spades, but it's not skillless. It's very skillful. It's all in service of the story. And, you know, the reason that I say it's a great movie, maybe not a great horror movie, is because the funny thing is, like, there's probably only really two things in the entire movie that are scary. Well, I shouldn't say that, but there's only two moments that are, I think, really supposed to, you know, put you into a state of fear. One is when Carrie's mom is coming at her with a knife. And then the other is something that became a horror cliche, which is when her hand unexpectedly comes out of the ground and grabs a girl in a dream sequence. That became, you know, Friday the 13th rips that off by having Jason come out of the lake at the end. And that's just been like a horror cliche ever since. You know, the last minute, the killer's not really dead. Although, you know, the funny thing, and this is something to get into, is that it's kind of the one moment in the movie when Carrie really is like a monster. And that's the thing, you know, the reason that it's maybe not so much a horror movie is because it's a tragedy where the main character is the outsider, the outside force that's disrupting normality, except the whole point of Carrie is that the normality of high school is so awful that, you know, for something to disrupt it like Carrie kind of becomes a catharsis. And that's kind of where you get into the genius of Stephen King. And, you know, I'm not using that word lightly. I mean, he obviously has a great talent because of the success that he's had. The genius of Stephen King is uniquely, you know, he's very in tune with with the kind of, you know, subconscious of America. And one of the, you know, great themes of America's subconscious is the revenge of the nerd. I mean, this is why Columbine freaked everybody out, because everybody's had thoughts of, maybe I'm outing myself by saying everybody, but a lot of people have had thoughts of, wouldn't it be great to murder everybody at your school because they're all fucking assholes? And that's what Carrie taps into. I mean, that's what Carrie the book taps into, and obviously that's what Carrie the movie taps into. And, you know, it's just amazingly gripping because, I mean, nobody dies until Carrie, you know, freaks out at the prom. And, you know, even if you – even if, you know, let's say you're walking into this movie in 1976 and you don't know that – well, you know what? They put the prom on the poster though, so you're going to know that that's coming. But also my point is, you know, about 20 minutes or so into the movie, they've set up that there's the prom and, you know, William Catt is going to bring her there and there's going to be a prank, you know, on Carrie. And, you know, unless you're – really thick, you can surmise that Carrie's burgeoning psychic powers are going to be used in some kind of revenge at the prom. So, you know, knowing that the movie is just building up to this one, you know, inferno at the end, it's really great. It doesn't matter that you know that – in fact, the inevitability works for it. That's – it works really well as a tragedy because you know that that's what it's all building up to. And when you get to the point where Carrie is being crowned prom queen, it's just – you know, the tragedy is exquisite because, like, you know, this is the one happy moment that this poor girl has ever had. And you know where it's going. And De Palma knows that too. That's why he stretches out, like, the moment of the dropping of the bucket, you know, into, like, what, 5 minutes? It's like, yeah, 5 minutes of slow motion. He's dragging it out as long as humanly possible. And it just works and it's spectacular. And who knew that Officer Ann Lewis was such a bitch in high school? I mean, my gosh.
It really does change how you read RoboCop, doesn't it? I mean, she's really not very nice.
Who knew that she would survive that car crash with John Travolta and, you know, eventually move to Detroit to leave her, you know, life in the town of, what, Bates? I guess the town's not called Bates, but it's Bates High School. Anyways, I'm sorry. I just had to get the RoboCop joke out of the way.
Yeah, it's it's from the first second, and I have not seen a lot of De Palma 70s stuff. I've never seen Dressed to Kill. I've never seen Sisters. Never seen Fan with the Paradise. Actually, if I look, I bet the first De Palma I've seen is Blowout, which is 81, and yeah. Blowout's really stylized. But yeah, Blowout stylizing does not immediately start. But, I mean, Carrie, the opening, you know, credits, yeah, the opening titles are stylized. Yeah.
Right. It's the you're into slow motion in the second shot of the movie.
And it's this, and it's the beautiful Pino D'Agiano score. And
oh,
it's just,
God, the Pino D'Agiano score is fantastic.
It's just amazing.
I mean, the movie – I mean, I don't want to say that the movie owes itself to the score, but the score makes it way better than it would have been without, yeah, you know, more normal music.
Yeah, I mean, he just does a great job.
You know, D'Agiano is just a great composer for horror movies, period. He also did The Howling and Tourist Trap, which is a more obscure movie but a really great one.
Nobody uses him. So it raises a question. I mean, I think De Palma's stuck with him for a while, and then he sort of fell out of favor. But
Yeah.
It's just the best stuff. I mean, it's so good that Quentin Tarantino uses his stuff in his movies.
Well, speaking of Tarantino, I mean, I think Tarantino has been quoted some places as saying, like, that his number one influence is De Palma.
Which makes sense, yeah.
After watching Carrie, that makes perfect sense. There's a ton of stuff in Carrie that is straight out of, you know, or Tarantino took straight out of De Palma's work. Especially this split screen stuff. And how funny is it that there's so many diopter shots in this movie where, you know, you've got one thing in an extreme close-up on one side of the screen, and then on the other side there's something else, and both things are in focus. Like, there are so many shots of that, and then finally at the end, in the prom massacre scene, he finally just says, screw it, I'm just going to put a line down the middle of the screen and literally diopt, you know, bisect the screen.
Yeah, it's... I think the ending, which I probably have seen on something, you know, the scariest moments of movies or whatever, and I think that distracts from just how well made the rest of it is. And I mean, it's not...
It's easy to think of, like, the whole point of the movie is the prom massacre, but it's like...
But it's really not.
No.
And the movie poster sort of advertises it as some... As that thing. And
yeah,
always...
yeah, the tagline was, if you've got a taste for terror, take Carrie to the prom.
And I can't believe this is in a movie, so I think it must have been a shot, but isn't the... There was like a video box cover of it where it was Sissy Spacek covered in blood grinning, smiling, like she just won. It was like she'd won, but she was still covered in blood, and so it was
I don't
always...
I think I've ever seen that, but yeah, you know...
Like, it was something very disturbing, and that's not what the movie is at all. The majority of the movie is... Well, the movie is about her and her mother. And the whole prom thing is sort of just the... this is what bullying... Yeah, it's just...
Yeah, you know what? You know that documentary that's coming out, Bully? They should have just re-released Carrie.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a good year for bullies. You got the documentary, you got whatever with... presidential candidates, but yeah, and they're remaking Carrie, so we'll see if
are they?
Uh-huh.
No, because actually, when I tried to look up Carrie 1 on Netflix, and they only had apparently there was a 2002 made for TV remake.
There was that too, yeah, and it's just like I think that it was going to be a pilot. I think that actually.
Oh yeah,
was
just like the Firestar.
Yeah, I think that the Carrie remake is supposed to be better than Carrie 2.
Slash remake, yeah, it was supposed to be launch a series.
Because I think it ends with her, like, helping wayward children or something.
Right.
But yeah, so, I mean, most of the movie is just a high school movie, and it's a really unpleasant one because... Well, okay, so the movie opens with... Carrie's one of those ones, and I know you're not as wild about Black Swan as I am, but it's one of those movies where it's very strange that men made it, and it's based on a script, and it's the novels by a man, because the movie opens with Carrie getting her first period, and she's getting it late, and this is, of course, the 70s, so sex ed was not allowed, because that would just teach children to be promiscuous, and... Nobody had told her mother, being a religious nut and a very scary performance from Piper Laurie, hadn't told her. So the first, I'd say 15 minutes of the movie is dealing with the fact that she gets her period and she totally freaks out. And it's just the
after effects
of that.
Yeah, it really is funny about the male authorship. And I think Carol Clover, who wrote a great, you know, kind of academic work on horror, particularly post-70s slasher horror, Men, Women, and Chainsaws, I think it was her who kind of points out that, like, Stephen King is kind of using – there's some gender kind of bending that goes on in horror. Like, most horror fans are men, and yet, you know – you've got the final girl cliche, and it's women who are mostly being terrorized in films. And she makes this really good argument that, like, basically horror movies are for, like, effeminate men, or not effeminate, but, you know, kind of less than masculine men to kind of project themselves onto, you know, weak women. And it makes a lot of sense. And then she uses Carrie as this example, and she quotes Stephen King talking about Carrie. And basically Stephen King is describing his character kind of gender neutrally. It's not so much about the fact that Carrie's a girl as just the fact that she's, you know, an outcast. And,
right,
you know, I mean, I haven't read the book, so I don't know how much, you know, what the differences are. The screenplay wasn't by Stephen King, because this isn't Maximum Overdrive, but, you know, the period stuff, I mean, yeah, it's very, you know, kind of the awfulness of a woman, you know, a young woman having to come to terms with her body and hating her body and hating herself. Yeah, it's really remarkable that this movie was made entirely by men.
Especially De Palma, considering De Palma, of course, would sort of make a name for himself as exploitative, whether he actually is or not.
Yeah.
But if you look, I think Dress to Kill, right?
Dress to Kill. I was just trying, as you said that, I was trying to think of, like, what movies did De Palma get flack for? And I think it really just comes down to Dress to Kill.
And, well, I think Body Double, too. I mean, Body Double.
Oh, okay.
But Body Double, knowing De Palma is a response to Dress to Kill, the blow up over that. But then also, you know, he made, when he couldn't get a job, he made Femme Fatale overseas.
Yeah.
He's had lots of problems since, Mission Impossible? He just has never, when he finally became a blockbuster director, he wasn't able to sustain it. And there's a, by today's standards, there's a shocking amount of nudity in this movie.
The opening titles are a bunch of
actresses whose names you actually know, and it's not like, you know, today where that wouldn't happen. And
they're naked
very
in the locker
weird
room.
Yeah, it's just
and it's just matter of fact, right?
Yeah,
right,
and it's De Palma. It's very weird.
Actually, it's almost so matter of fact that it becomes, I don't know, it's like a Renaissance painting of,
yeah,
you know, naked nymphs or something. It's like, yeah, they're naked, but it's not supposed to be titillating you. You're just supposed to be in awe of their natural, you know, supple beauty.
And then they turn out to be very awful human beings, and so,
right,
you know.
Yeah. And, yeah, you know, speaking of how awful everybody in this movie is to Carrie, the only problem with the prom massacre thing is that it doesn't go on long enough. I mean, there's only, like, two people. Okay, well, we can argue this, but I guess my issue is that there's only two characters who die really explicit deaths during the prom massacre, and that's and they're both teachers. And I don't know, you see PJ Souls get fire hosed to death, but it's not very convincing. It looks like the fire hose is putting her to sleep or something. And yeah, Nancy Allen and John Travolta flip over in a car, but that's just an exploding car.
Yeah, that's not really that good of an ending for them. But no, I wasn't going to say that I have a problem with. I was just going to say that during Carrie 2, we can talk about what happens when you go overboard with it. Or not exactly, but we'll get to that. I also found the big massacre. I've been hearing about it for 20 years now.
Yeah, right.
And
no kidding.
It was just kind of lackluster.
But
I also think it's also unclear. It's unclear to me when does William Cat die?
Right.
When he gets hit on the head, or does he burn to death?
Does the bucket kill him? No, probably not. Yeah, no, I agree with that. And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that, like, you don't see enough destruction. Well, not destruction. Basically, like, the whole place, you know, lights on fire, and you've got, like, an amazing shot of Sissy Spacek walking with, you know, flames silhouetting her. But then basically you just see her leave the flaming building and the doors close behind her, and we're just left to assume that, you know, everybody's stuck in there and they're all burning. But yeah, the destruction, the human loss isn't quite explicit enough.
And then you get to one of my other problems with it is then the movie actually has its actual ending. The prom is not that big of a deal. The high school massacre is not that big of a deal. The movie's really about her and her religiously psychotic mother.
Right.
And I think it'll be interesting if they do that today to show a fundamentalist as a complete and utter psychopath. That'll be interesting to see how much flack a remake takes for doing that today when it's a much more touchy subject. Because, of course, Carrie was a very low budget. It was a huge hit for UA, for United Artists. And, you know, they didn't want to make it in the first place or something. And there's all sorts of trivia about it, like Sissy Spacek wasn't originally going to be in it and blah, blah, blah. But it's consistently depressing in a way that you do have little moments of hope, like one of the
a teacher will, you know, brush Carrie's hair out of her face and show her the mirror and be like, "Look, you're a beautiful girl." Yeah.
Yeah, or William Catt. I mean, I guess there's an argument you could say that William Catt was in on it, and so was.
It's, you know what? That's so ambiguous that, like, right. I was watching this with my girlfriend. I had to ask her, like, is William Catt and his sister in on this or not? Like, I couldn't quite tell.
And
they're not, but, like, it's almost ambiguous.
They actually layer it, so you're wondering if
they're
going to do it. Because it's like two people are planning something for Carrie at prom, and it's unclear that... I think the reason for that is because Amy Irving's character all of a sudden wakes up and is like, "I've been a terrible person. I need to redeem myself."
Right. That's the tricky bit.
Somewhat unbelievable. Well, because I mean, Carrie's really short too, right? I mean, it's about 95 minutes. I want to say how
long it is. 1 hour and 30.
Yeah, so it's 90 minutes. Or no, yeah. This one's saying 98, but whatever.
Well, I've got my copy of the movie right here.
So, yeah, I mean, it's not a long movie. Yeah, so, I mean, they just sort of have to rush through some things. And there's a little bit of kicking around with stuff. Time passes in some strange ways, but...
Yeah.
I mean, as a high school movie, it's nightmarish in a way that... You know,
it's not really the nightmarishness of it isn't that it's true to life, it's that it's completely over the top. Like, you know, these characters are just hysterical, even the ostensibly normal ones, like the scene where the woman's, you know, gym coach slaps Nancy Allen in the face. I mean, you want to talk about stuff, you know, that couldn't happen in the movies. How about stuff that just couldn't happen in real life? I mean, her ass would be fired in about, you know, half a second for that.
I mean, in the 70s, were teachers allowed to hit their kids? I mean, hey.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
That was one of the things I was wondering about. I'm like, wow, was it really that hard to, you know, contain Nancy Allen in the 70s? I mean, she's just terrible. Well, the other thing is that we got to talk about John Travolta. A little bit.
He's so in welcome back Cotter mode in this that was this before or after? It couldn't possibly have been after Welcome Back Cotter. And then I look it up and it's like, oh, okay, it came out a year after the first year of Welcome Back Cotter. So he probably was like shooting the first season of Welcome Back Cotter at the same time that he, you know, shot this over however many weeks.
Yeah.
And that's why you've got – but it's just so strange that he's like in this very, you know, it's the John Travolta that, you know, a whole generation of girls in the 70s, you know, were in love with. And he's like, you know, killing a pig.
Well, that and he's beating the crap out of Nancy Allen.
Oh, and he's slapping Nancy Allen around. Right. But he's still the, oh, my God, you guys kind of, you know.
Yeah, he's a complete moron and he's an abusive boyfriend.
Right.
And, you know, the very, I guess the troubling part would be, of course, that the script in De Palma sort of make you understand why you'd beat the crap out of Nancy Allen.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you mentioned how depressing it is. There really aren't any good people. And not even Carrie gets off the hook because, and this is the kind of tricky thing, Carrie is this sympathetic monster, even more so than, you know, your classic Frankenstein archetype, because she has intelligence and you really do want to see her massacre the school at the end. And you know what? But like when Sissy Spacek, you know, when her eyes are wide open and she's got, you know, that intense look and she's caked in blood, it's just this like instantly, you know, classic horror image. And like, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, De Palma and Stephen King have sympathy for Carrie, but you know, when she's caked in blood and is backlit by flames and has those big, you know, eyes. When she's walking home from the prom, like down the road and then like up into her mother's house, I mean, she's practically walking like a zombie, you know. Mm-hmm. The movie has no choice but to sort of dehumanize her at that point, because dehumanizing her into, you know, this avenging, you know, inhuman thing is part of how, you know, she gets her strength, you know, when she stops trying to fit in and, you know, just embraces the thing that makes her different, well, besides everything else, but embraces her outsider status to the point of, you know, having it be this, you know, this superpower, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And then it reverses again, because she comes home from prom and her crazy mom tries to kill her, and her mom is way scarier than she is, you know, and her mom is actually a bad person. So like, you're really, you go back to being, you know, you're never really scared for Carrie. You feel sorry for her. And then at the very end, you know, you're scared for her. And then the movie flips it on you again with that dream sequence with the hand coming out of the ground, you could make a good case that that's like really kind of undoes all the work that the movie was doing to make her sympathetic. But I mean, what the hell, you know, it got people good, you know? Yeah.
I mean, it's just, well, I think one of the interesting things is that, even though Amy Irving,
yeah,
that's her name, she has such a big role in the story, she really doesn't have much of a presence in it.
Yeah, and well, there's not much. Yeah,
there's really nothing for her to do, because William Catt takes over with this big old blonde afro, and it's just.
You know, the only thing I really was familiar with William Catt from before this was House. The Sean Cunningham.
Oh, yeah, but he has short hair in that.
Yeah, he's got short hair in that, and he's playing a horror writer. Synchronicity. Wow.
Yeah, he, of course, did The Greatest American Hero, which I did not. I saw that as a kid. But, yeah, I mean, it's, all the acting's good. The teacher.
I wasn't expecting to see Sidney Lassick as the teacher, old Cheswick, you know, who wants his cigarettes. And he's hateable too. I mean, there's everybody in this movie sucks. Like, you know, because what, William Catt reads his god awful pro environmentalist poem, and Carrie says it's beautiful, you know, and then the class laughs at her, and then fucking Cheswick piles on Carrie too. He's like, beautiful. Oh well, la di da, you know.
Yeah, and then
so then you're glad to see him electrocuted at the end.
Well, I like the. There's also that nice moment where she asks William Catt why he likes her, and he goes, "Well, you like my poem." And he's like, "Yeah, I didn't even write it, but you still liked it." And it's like, I think they're able to, like, it's very awkward because the character of Carrie seems very socially stunted. Like, it's like, what if a seventh grader ended up in high school or something, and. It does a really good job with that while still.
Yeah, and yeah. William Catt's character is kind of, you know, His ambiguity towards Carrie is a lot better developed than Sue Snell's. I mean, that's her character's name.
Amy Irving.
Hell, alliterated names. Amy Irving's, because with William Catt, you know, he spends time with Carrie and he goes from, you know, hating her or just, you know, disregarding her as much as everybody else to actually liking her. And they even make the point to show that, you know, he really did, you know, learn, you know, grow to like her and felt, you know, sympathy for her, because right after the bucket drops, you see him in slow motion going like, what the hell?
Yeah.
So they make a point to show that he wasn't a bad guy in the end.
He still gets killed, though.
Yeah, he still gets killed off.
And so does that teacher. Yeah.
Well, that's another thing about like the nihilism of this movie is that the one teacher who was nice to Carrie is laughing at her too at the end. And she's the other voice in Carrie's head that you hear, and this is something that's been parodied a lot, or something from that scene which gets parodied a lot. Carrie hearing, they're all gonna laugh at you, her mom saying that, and then you hear the teacher's voice saying, you can trust me, Carrie, they're all gonna laugh at you, you can trust me, Carrie, and they cut to the teacher and she's laughing too.
Yeah, and I think that, what was I gonna say? Well, it almost makes you wonder if, I don't know if you've ever heard that in Jackie Chan movies, it's very, his morals clause will never let the bad guy get away with it.
I never heard that.
Yeah, so even if Jackie, it's like, I guess in Super Cop 1, in the Hong Kong version, because he was operating without a license or something, he goes to jail at the end. Because in all Jackie Chan, or something. And it's almost like, now, does the teacher get killed because she was beating the crap out of Nancy Allen and so she had to get killed?
No, I think it's just a little nihilism there. Nah, I don't know. I mean, this movie isn't really, you know, going back to what I was saying at the beginning, it's not a traditional horror movie in that it's not Dracula and Frankenstein, but it's also not even a traditional horror movie of the 70s in that it's not a slasher movie or a haunted house movie or something like that. You know, you've got a very complicated kind of, you know, the thing that makes it horror isn't, you know, is I don't know, it's dread of the inevitable, which makes it a tragedy.
Where was American Horror at this point? 76.
Well, it's funny you should say, because I think I was kind of reminded that we needed to watch this because I read this book, Shock Value, which came out a couple of years ago, and it's kind of a reassessment of 70s horror, which seems like it's something that's been, you know, completely well documented at this point, and it has. But what this book does is kind of, you know, try to put it all into a new context, and it sort of looks it has a very interesting look at horror movies that were made by mainstream directors on their way to becoming mainstream directors, or at least mainstream 70s directors, because it talks a lot about this, and it talks a lot about Rosemary's Baby by Roman Polanski,
right.
And it talks a lot about what was the third one? It was Rosemary's Baby, this, and The Exorcist.
Okay.
And, you know, and then, so the thing that like De Palma and William Friedkin and Roman Polanski have in common is that like neither three of those guys wanted to be quote unquote horror movie directors. They didn't want to be, you know, John Carpenter, George Romero, or, you know, those folks. But they still did horror movies, and their horror movies were really influential and kind of unique too. I mean, yeah, definitely unique. So anyways, to answer your question, this is 1976. So we're at the point where, you know, you've kind of – the two watershed movies that kind of mark the beginning of new horror were Night of the Living Dead and Rosemary's Baby, and that's 68 and 69. So you're a few years into that, and you're kind of at the point where horror doesn't have like the formulaic kind of the new formulas are still being developed, and even the slasher movie hasn't really been developed yet. Like the only slasher movie you've got is the American one is Black Christmas from a couple of years earlier. I'm sorry, I'm digressing way too much. Let me try to answer your question really straight to the point. This is the last classic mainstream horror movie before Halloween comes out and people associate horror with slasher movies.
Okay.
In other words, you know, it was made at the right time. It was made before, you know, the really, you know, supposedly surefire subgenre of horror was established. So horror was really like in its ascendancy and being, and this is kind of the key point that Shock Value hones in on, being taken seriously by critics for the first time.
Okay.
Like for the very first time. Night of the Living Dead and Rosemary's Baby were the horror movies that made it okay for like serious movie critics in the New York Times and wherever else to write serious reviews of horror movies. And, you know, I think it's because of that that you have William Friedkin doing a horror movie and Brian De Palma doing a horror movie like this, even if that's not what they want to do. And, you know, I guess that's why you could say that Carrie's not really scary. It's more just, you know, a movie of tragedy and dread and, you know, high drama. But not even. It's really just, you know, tragedy. It's not quite horror unless, you know, you consider tragedy a kind of horror, which it could be. It's more like an existential horror.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Is that breaking it down enough?
It is. Yeah, I just was... Well, because, yeah, Halloween hadn't hit yet. I'd forgotten about Black Christmas.
Yeah, it's just that Black Christmas was, you know, the Halloween before Halloween. It's just that Black Christmas wasn't a big movie for whatever reason.
And then The Changeling. Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is that in the 70s, before slasher movies, there was a certain amount of supernatural horror that might have started with Rosemary's Baby, and then for certain,
yeah, and continues on through to The Exorcist, and then continues on to the religious themes that are in Carrie.
Right, and the religious themes, I just think were shocking to me that they were able to do this in 76.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, if Piper Laurie isn't the most hateable Christian in film history, I don't know who is. And also, you know, there's a little... De Palma doesn't quite go there, I think, because he has such contempt for Piper Laurie's character. But there's an interesting kind of moral ambiguity about, you know, the scene where Piper Laurie tells Carrie that her power is, you know, satanic. And Carrie wants to go to the prom, and she's literally using her powers to restrain her mom.
And right.
It's kind of this hint at the violence that's to come. And, you know, put yourself into Piper Laurie's shoes for 2 seconds. I mean, your daughter has mind powers and she's throwing you across the room with them. Like, you know, to most normal people, even if you're not, you know, a crazy, you know, psycho Christian fundamentalist, that's a little frightening and a little potentially evil. You know, if you believe in the devil, then, you know, that certainly seems like demonic possession. I mean, heck, that's what Linda Blair was doing in The Exorcist. She was making stuff fly around the room. So, you know, you've got this kind of ambiguity about, you know, is Carrie's power too much for her to handle? And is it, you know, if Carrie hadn't been killed, you know, or if she hadn't killed herself, you know, after the events of the prom in the movie, would Carrie have become, you know, like a monster in a sense? Would she have, you know, killed others who hadn't done her wrong because she was just, you know, turned into that by events and stuff and by a power that was too big for her. And again, De Palma doesn't quite go into it, but, you know, it's there in that one scene where she's, you know, restraining her mom. I think there's even a line. I think Sissy Spacek even says, like, I'm in charge now.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I'm the one in control here.
And this is the first Stephen King adaptation, too.
Yeah, we didn't even mention that, but yeah, the first of many, 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 many.
And then you, of course, I think, is the next one The Shining?
Is it? No, the next one, well, actually, there's this kind of, you know, intertwining of the 70s horror movement and Stephen King through this, and then through the second one, which was Tobe Hooper's TV movie of Salem's Lot.
Right, yes.
Which was 3 years after this. And then the third Stephen King movie was The Shining. And the interesting thing about The Shining, and Shock Value points this out, is that if it weren't for horror movies of the 70s, if it weren't for horror becoming respectable, critically respectable in the 70s and embraced by serious filmmakers, you wouldn't have had Stanley Kubrick announcing that he was going to make the ultimate horror film.
And also, that's true, but I was going to go for the more that Kubrick, I mean, I haven't read the novel. I've seen some of the miniseries that Stephen King likes. The Shining is sort of horror, but with the slasher.
Yeah, it's funny.
It does all together a little. Yeah,
it does. I mean, it's half haunted house movie, half slasher movie. But as far as trying to like creep you out and you know give you goose flesh, there's way more of you know. The Shining is trying way harder to be a quote unquote horror movie than Carrie is.
Yeah.
You know, lots more, you know, deliberately otherworldly, creepy imagery. And again, that's the thing about Carrie, you know. I mean, nobody dies until the last 20 minutes. It's all building up to it. So, yeah, I'd say that about does it for Carrie. Obviously, there's more to say because it's a great movie. And, you know, I'll just, you know, give it the highest recommendation and say that even if you feel like, you know, as I did, that you had practically seen it already, it's still worth seeing. It's still a great movie and, you know, very powerful, very stylish, well acted, everything. Great movie.
Yeah. Very nice surprise.
So, you know, you mentioned earlier how depressing Carrie was. And, you know, I think my comment, and I actually watched Carrie 2 right after Carrie. I don't know how I did it. I think I was up late and I couldn't get to sleep. And I actually watched these two movies back to back. And, you know, I guess my line on Carrie 2 vis-a-vis Carrie 1 is that Carrie is a profoundly sad movie.
Carrie 2 is profoundly sad, too.
Carrie 2 is more sad pathetic.
Okay, so the thing I found, I remember when this came.
Me too.
I think
there were shots in it that I remembered from the trailer.
Well, here's what's really weird about it is that I think it came out in 99, and I think by that time I was reading darkhorizons.com back before they became, regurgitated AP stories, but back when they were still a movie rumors site, kind of like Ain't It Cool News, the way Ain't It Cool News used to be before all these guys got corporate, or whatever the equivalent would be, before, you know, Hollywood started actually paying them. And so I, like, vaguely followed this and, like, all the troubles of it and, you know, who was going to be in it from the original. And so now I'm, like, reading on Wikipedia that they'd been planning it since 96 and with the same lead, who would have then been 21 because she's 24 when they make it now. And then it was based on a sex scandal of the Spur Posse. So Carrie 2. Carrie 2 is a little bit different than Carrie 1. Carrie 1 is it's a bunch of mean girls, basically. Carrie 2 is about a group of high school football players who...
They score points
by scoring with girls. So, I mean, it's statutory rape. I mean, it's coercion. I don't know if we're going to go the whole they actually raped anybody route. But, I mean, they're criminals.
I totally forgot about that Spurs thing. That was topical at the time, right?
Yeah, so they're criminals. The bad guys in this are criminals. They terrorize her. They assault her. You know, they're criminals. They're not, like, good guys. The implication is that, you know, the twit kid from Home Improvement beats up Mina Suvari, and so she kills herself. I mean, it's like, yeah. These are really bad guys. So I was actually watching the movie wondering if when they finally got around to killing them, if, you know, it'd be shown as an, you know, if Carrie 2 would be, if the Rage, would she'd be like a superhero.
Yeah, she is like a superhero.
And so, you know, it's, it doesn't seem like they got it, though, because, well...
Well, I mean, obviously we're having to weigh the artistic, you know, intent of this film against its incompetence, but, well, in the first place, and this is something that really started in the 90s, I feel, you've really, you know, got this girl who's way too good-looking to be playing an outsider character, and yet she's playing an outsider character. But you've also got the knowledge, you know, everybody's seen Carrie 2, you know, who – it doesn't matter if they've seen Carrie. They know how it ends. They know where it's going. And they know that, you know, basically Carrie is a figure of sympathy. And that's probably why, you know, the antagonists are even more kind of, you know, cartoonishly evil in this. They almost make her a little more of a superhero in this because her tattoo inexplicably.
Yeah, she has a costume, sort of.
Her tattoo inexplicably turns into a quasi-costume. Yeah, she's got a rose tattoo and the vines spread out all over her. And I think that was something else in the trailer that, you know, you knew that I remembered from it. But, what really doesn't work is, you know, Carrie's tormentors need to be primarily female. I mean, as we were saying, Carrie 1 is such a movie about the dynamics of women. And when you've got, you know, a group of evil male jocks in Carrie 2, it's, you know, a little more of a men versus, you know, exploitative men versus exploited women thing, which doesn't work for a retelling of Carrie.
No. And so Amy Irving shows up and...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Amy Irving is in this. Sue Snell is now a guidance counselor at the high school, the one that they rebuilt, I guess, you know, because that makes perfect sense. And by the way, it's been 20-something years, and they still haven't cleared up the rubble from the destroyed gymnasium from the first movie.
All I can really say about Amy Irving is she clearly had a terrible, terrible divorce lawyer, because if she didn't get more money out of Spielberg that she would never have to do something like this in her life, then clearly she did not have a good divorce lawyer.
I forgot she was married to Spielberg.
Yeah, well, I think that she probably didn't get a lot. There's a lot of good stories about her Slackers. No, not that one. The 70s cinema book has all sorts of stories about their very rocky marriage. But anyway, she's awful. She's absolutely awful. And when she dies, it's very nice that she actually just...
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, before I comment on that, we forgot to mention that Brian De Palma actually was married to Nancy Allen for a bit of time there.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, speaking of directors and their ingenues. But anyways, yeah, you know, look, having Sue Snell come back in Carrie 2 is pointless. And I mean, this is the funny thing about horror movies at this time, is that like that they even felt obligated to connect it to the first movie to the point of having one of the actors come back is, you know, I don't know if it's admirably stupid or stupidly admirable, but as far as her death is concerned, they completely dropped the ball, because Amy Irving's the only person in the movie who knows what's going on, and she's, you know, she knows what's going to happen the whole time. She knows that this girl has got the power and there's going to be a disaster. Somehow she knows this. It's like it's practically all leading up to a big scene where she's, you know, like, stop, Carrie 2. You don't have to do this. It doesn't have to be like this. You know, put the gun down. And instead, they just kill her in a cheap joke. She's killed accidentally because someone else that Carrie is killing, like, you know, Amy Irving gets caught on the end of the same knife or something.
Yeah. What is interesting about this is that it was directed by a woman. It wasn't written by a woman. It was written by some terrible, terrible writer who also wrote some TV shows. But it was directed by a woman, and I found that very interesting because it... the sort of misogynistic football players.
Yeah.
They're supposed to be funny.
Yeah.
So their jokes are supposed, we're supposed to laugh at the jokes, which just seems like if you make the point, well, originally the director was Robert Mandel, who directed FX, which I have a great affection for, and you know, he didn't have a very good career after that, and so he he dropped out of it.
Yeah.
And they hired her, and I always assumed
Kat Shea with two T's and a K. Kat Shea.
She's a Corman protege, I believe. But an 80s Corman protege, and I think that there's a definite study in...
Well, you know what? You want to talk about movies that are, you know, sympathetic to women. I mean, I think she got this job because she directed Poison Ivy with...
with Drew Barrymore.
With Batgirl. Oh, no. Yeah. Drew Barrymore.
But... Yeah, so it's just very awkward. And, I mean, she's incompetent and terrible. I think the only good scene is – the only good directorial moment she has is when Mina Suvari jumps off the roof.
Yeah.
The cracking of the windshield. There's just something really wrong about it, and it seems like they didn't intend it to be so wrong, and it just works. Because the rest of the movie's violence doesn't work.
Right.
Though it does Piranha 3D. what's his name? Who did that?
Alex Asha.
Alex Asha has clearly seen Carrie 2 because the dick getting chopped off joke is in Carrie 2.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And by the way, that's one of the few things that I remember because I didn't see this movie when it came out, but my friend who did, that was the first thing he told me about was a guy's junk gets harpooned in this. And I'm like, oh, cool.
So... I mean, it's like, okay,
Speaking of Mina Suvari as Carrie 2's friend, it's awful because, you know, they set her up in the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever that she's Carrie 2's best bud, and then she jumps off the roof because she finds out that she was just a pawn in the jock's, sex game, which, you know, really, folks, is not the grounds for throwing yourself to a violent death.
But it's implied that she got beat up a little bit by...
Okay.
Or at least shaken up by the Zachary Ty Bryan
yeah.
from he's the dumb kid from Home Improvement.
Well, I just wanted to mention their friendship because of how cheesy it is that they establish their friendship is that they both have the same rose tattoo on their shoulder.
And they lick it. They lick their fingers and touch each other's rose tattoo.
Yeah, because that's what best friends with matching tattoos
besties do
in high school. And I guess that's some kind of artistic justification for the rose tattoo spreading across her at the end.
Oh, it is. But I was actually just going to say that, yes, I suppose if you did get roughed up by Zachary Ty Bryan, you might want to kill yourself.
Yeah, the direction Cat Williams is, I mean, I don't know. I'm sure she can direct normal movies competently, but you probably couldn't have found a worse, you know, special effects director to do a movie about telekinesis because she's so unconfident. She has such a lack of confidence.
The black and white
in her own ability to do the telekinesis scenes that when Carrie uses her telekinesis, they go to black and white shaky cam. It's really bad.
Well, now, okay, so this is pre-Blair Witch. This is...
Actually, this would be maybe the same year as Blair
Witch.
It's
the same year, but it came out in March.
Okay. So, yeah.
It also...
And it's not shaky cam like, you know, handheld camera.
It's just
shaking the camera back and forth.
It also is pre-American Pie, which is very interesting because it has two of the stars of that movie in it.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, you know, before that came out or whatever. And, you know, Mina Suvari's always sucked. I mean, but I always thought that the Eddie K. Thomas guy was reasonably okay. He's so bad in this. I wish he died. And, I mean, the jokes are really bad. His joke when he sees the house on fire is, well, it looks like a killer party.
Yeah.
And you're just kind of like, wow.
Yeah,
like, was your, you know, SAG card really worth doing that to yourself? Like,
yeah.
It has some of the acting in the movie so bad that I think Jason London easily gives the best performance.
He's the teacher, right?
No, he's not the teacher. He's the love interest, who just looks like he's her teacher, because even though he's only 28, he looks like 32 years older than her.
Yeah, all the high school kids in this movie are way too old. That's a minor quibble, but, you know, it's just another technical problem.
Oh, my God. Okay, what else do I want to bitch about? The soundtrack? Can I bitch about the soundtrack a little? How bad it is with the... Yeah, but then, hold on, wait. At the end, while she's carrying out at the party and killing everybody, there's like a song that has samples of Piper Laurie saying, they're going to laugh at you. And it's shuka, 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 they're going to laugh at you, shuka, shuka, shuka.
I think I blocked that out because it was really late at night when I finally finished watching this. But I mean, I guess the thing that made me able to watch this late at night is that I was waiting for the massacre and I was waiting for that harpoon through the guy's junk that I knew
See,
was
See, if you told me about that, at least I would have been looking forward to that.
Right. But yeah, the massacre scene, I mean – Well, basically, it's, you know, sure, it's more explicit than the Carrie one in terms of violence, but it's also more ridiculous because in the meantime, we've had Hellraiser movies. So, of course, Carrie 2 has to kill someone with CDs that fly through the air. And I mean, it's just really, I'm trying to fast forward to the massacre in my copy of Carrie 2 so that I can better comment on the badness of it.
Holy shit, this movie cost $21 million.
That's a lot of money.
I mean, is it like Superman Returns? Like, $10 million of it was spent pre-production on failed, like... Wow, that's a lot of money for this thing. It looks like it was filmed, you know, in the middle of nowhere. All of the acting's bad. Well, the cinematography's actually really good. Maybe he cost a lot. The music's terrible, like the score. I didn't bitch about that, but wow.
Yeah.
Well,
here's something about the massacre scene. It's you know, it takes place at a party, at a house party, which does not have the thematic resonance of a high school prom because, you know, it the prom is happening in the institution where, you know, this cruelty and badness is allowed to go on.
Right.
And you've also got the teachers there and, you know, they have to get theirs too. And, you know, the whole point of having it be at the prom is that, you know, her biggest humiliation happens, you know, mere moments after her, you know, social triumph. And there's none of that in Carrie too, because all that happens is she shows up at this party and, I mean, you know, all the beats of Carrie 2 are stolen straight out of Carrie 1 as far as, you know, there's like a good-looking guy who takes an interest in her and, you know, they're going out. And then – but then like, you know, they feel that they have to match the intensity of the bucket of pig's blood at the end of Carrie 2. And the way that they match that intensity is just – it's just a little too over the top. I mean, it's like – okay, they taped her having sex and they show it at the party and that's humiliating. But then it's not just that, it's that like they're holding her, they're restraining her and forcing her to watch.
Right, that's illegal. I mean, they're criminals, you know, they deserve to die. It's like the Punisher. She's like Lady Punisher. I mean,
Yeah,
I mean, you know, and I think that that's like kind of the funny part about it is at the very end when Jason London gets there, there's sort of this implication that he totally would have forgiven her for killing all those people.
Right.
Including his ex-girlfriend that she kills right in front of him. There's like this implication that it'd be okay. They could just go off together and it'd be cool.
Maybe this could have been Carrie the series. I mean, that is how it would have happened if she didn't bring the house down on herself at the end. Which, by the way, is another thing that they felt obligated to copy from Carrie 1 that there isn't the justification for in this because, I mean, Carrie, you know, Sissy Spacek brings the house down on herself because she's just had to kill her own mom and she has nothing and, you know, it's like this moment of, you know, despair. But in Carrie 2, like, hey, her she finds out that her, you know, that her new boyfriend wasn't really in on the joke, and he really did love her. And he's alive. Yeah. He's not dead. And she got shot by a flare gun, sure, but I don't know.
This is 99. So
yeah.
It's after Scream. There's a Scream joke in it. And it's after Halloween H2O. And so there's like this setup scene with the teacher. The director also makes fun of fat people. She's really high class. There's this scene where they're talking about literature to sort of analog the poem scene. And so Jason London, who is not the worst of the two Londons, Jeremy London is the worst. He's the one from Mallrats. Jason London, I think, was on the show Fly. Was he on? I want to see if he was on this show. Maybe he wasn't. Oh, he's the one who was in Broken Vessels. He was in Dazed and Confused, which, of course, is the, you know, movie where every teen actor from the 90s sort of started from. But anyway, he was in I'll Fly Away. No, the other one was in I'll Fly Away, which was a very good show. But anyway, there's this they lay this, you know, subplot, or not subplot, but there's this detail about how Romeo and Juliet is not actually a tragedy, because the only way these two can be together in love is in death. And so they're And so I kept waiting for the fucker to die. And he doesn't die. And so, I mean, what was the point of that scene? It felt like a recycled classroom scene from some other movie.
I mean, that's what I'm saying, is like there's all this stuff that they felt obligated to just parallel from the first movie that, you know, it's just mechanical and it's not justified. And it just feels like, always just gratuitous and for its own sake. And one more thing on that note is, like, well, Jay London lives, and then, you know, the way that they try to parallel the, you know, Carrie's hand coming out of the ground at the end of Carrie 1 is by having him have a nightmare of Carrie 2, which makes no sense whatsoever. He just has a nightmare that she shows up, and then suddenly, like, she crumbles into dust
after they,
like,
kiss, because he was going to forgive her for killing all those people. He was okay with that.
Then it's like, but it's just like, what does that even mean? You know, it doesn't mean anything. It's just cheap. It's just like a cheap CG effect.
And then it ends with him in like this mirror, and he's being mirrored behind him and in front of him and behind him, and goes on and on and on. And it's like, it you think they're trying to be profound.
That really shows how dumb the director is.
I mean, because,
it's an idiot's idea of profundity.
Yeah, it's just,
wow. So, also, speaking of bad CG, I am rewatching the massacre scene for Carrie 2, and there is some bad CG in this, you know, like the harpoon flying around. Man, there's a lot of harpoons in this house. Head of the household must have been a fisherman or something.
Okay, yeah, let's talk a little bit about that.
CDs flying around are bad CG, too.
The rich kids. Okay, so it takes place in a small town where all of the cool kids are rich, and the lame kids are Mina Suvari. And I think Carrie, too, whatever her name is, she lives in a trailer.
Yeah, she lives in a cliched trailer, family environment.
So apparently there are like 6 to 9 poor kids in this school, and the rest of them are all really rich, and they live in cool houses. With a guy who has like a junior Hitler mustache going. So it makes absolutely no sense in the context of a small town and that sort of thing. I think the only thing that I found amusing about the movie was is that the football coach sexually abuses the male players. I mean, he makes them for him. Yeah, I was like, that's kind of cool.
There's a better movie there.
I mean, that's not really funny. That's scary. You know, that's an issue.
It's Freddy's Revenge all over again.
But Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's, there's a mall somewhere where they go to, and they, like, go to expensive places in the mall, and then they shoplift or something, because they're rebellious teenagers. So it's kind of like, one of those 80s movies about, it's like The Karate Kid with girls, only in a small town, which makes no sense, because there wouldn't be a mall.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's frustratingly stupid throughout the entire movie, I would say. I don't think it ever slows down a little bit to be unstupid.
No. And it's an hour and 40 fucking minutes. I mean,
it's so long.
It's 10 minutes longer than the original Carrie. I mean, if it's not unless the filmmakers really thought that they were going to be topping the original Carrie, they shouldn't have made it longer than the first one. And also, speaking of stupid incompetence, you know, one of the bitchy girls who gets hers at the end of the party massacre, Carrie 2 kills her by exploding her glasses. And, you know, there's some bad CG there, and the glass flies into her eyes. And, yeah, that sucks. You know, that's
and that's difficult. When she shoots off the guy's junk.
Right.
She, yeah.
But that's also – but then in the very next shot, she dies. And I'm sorry that – you know, glass flying into your eyes would be horrific, but it wouldn't kill you within seconds, which is what happened.
Carrie, too, might have been moving the glass deeper into her eyes. She has telekinesis.
Oh, yeah.
That scene, so they get the three people you want to see get killed the most.
Right.
And they sort of, I mean, oh, it's poetic. They shoot off... You clearly didn't watch Home Improvement because, you know, my hatred of the dumb kid. Like, there was an actual episode about this. It was the episode where Jonathan Taylor Thomas makes fun of the blonde-haired dude from this for being stupid. And it's like, it was like a very special episode about how, like, it's okay to be stupid. You know, some people just need more help, you know, and yeah. So... Yeah, they shoot off his junk, right? Because he killed Mina Suvari, and so he pays for that. But, I mean, it's not like a rewardingly long, exploitative death sequence. Mina Suvari's death sequence was longer, and all she did was break her neck on the
on
the dash. I mean, it's just...
Yeah, and another problem with the massacre scene. It's not even a problem. It's just cheap cheesiness. They reference the fact – well, they reference, you know, the Carrie's arm coming out of the ground by having her pop out of a swimming pool that she's been flare-gunned into and grabbing one of the guys. Yeah, this is the thing. I mean, this movie is for people whose familiarity with Carrie is, you know, at the same level that – ours was, only probably not even as much, you know. It's like if you know about the prom if you know about the prom massacre and the religiousness and you know, you're set. That's all you need to know.
Of course the religiousness
and the arm coming out of the ground. Yeah, and the religiousness is it's here, but it's kind of inconsequential. I mean, basically we're supposed to believe that Piper Laurie had a sister who was just as much of a nut as she was, and she slept with the same.
The mother supposed to be Piper Laurie's sister too?
Oh no! I'm sorry. It's just the fact. No, you're right. It's just a coincidence that Carrie 2 and Carrie had the same father.
Right.
Their moms just both happened to be religious nuts.
Who apparently is out there hooking up with the ladies. So you have an endless, you know, franchise here. This could go on forever.
Right. Like, where's...
This guy's like Charles Barkley. Like, what if he was? What if he was Charles Barkley?
Yeah, this movie really makes you want to find out about Carrie's dad and how he managed to carry this. By the way, this movie declares that telekinesis is in a recessive gene
that can be passed by the mail,
right? So who's Carrie's dad running around sleeping with Piper Laurie and other freak shows and creating these telekinetic kids? Anyways,
especially when you take into account that it takes place in the same town, The sequel is 23 years later, right?
Right.
So that means that the dad came back to town after Carrie had had her massacre.
Yeah.
Knocked up the other lady and left again.
My hero. What a cool guy.
Okay, if they had actually opened the movie with like a shot of that, like if they'd opened the movie with some guy walking down the street and he sees the house like sunk into the ground and his response to it is, you know, I gotta get me some, you know.
Yeah. Oh shit, my old pump is gone.
I need a new pump, you know, like, and then he just heads off and he whistles. You know, that would be so much better.
Speaking of connections to the first movie, Carrie 2's, actually I'm going to pin it on Cat O'Shea. Cat O'Shea's idea, it's just Shea. I'm adding too much Irishness. Cat Shea's idea of competent flashbacks to the first movie is to flash frames of white, have a high-pitched noise, and then show, like, 0.5 seconds of scenes from the first movie.
Well, did you read why there's so little?
No, I didn't.
It's because she wasn't initially allowed to include footage from the first one. And then she showed the movie to Sissy Spacek. And Sissy Spacek was like, no, I want to be part of that. And so Sissy Spacek gave her permission. So clearly Sissy Spacek went insane.
I was about to say, aw, Sissy.
She went crazy at some point in her life. Or maybe she had a bad divorce attorney too, and she wanted some Carrie 2 money.
I hope that's the reason. Because, I mean, before I started watching Carrie 2, I was thinking, there's no way they would have the rights to flashback to the first movie, but they did.
During the beginning, so it opens with the mother going crazy and getting taken off by the cops. But there's this scene where the cop is trying to reassure the little kid, one of the worst child actors. I mean, just, you know, you wish it was Jake Lloyd in a wig, you know, you wish it was, I mean, for goodness sake, you know, like cut off Hayden Christensen's legs and let him do it. Let him play the little girl. They use this music where it's like they make slash noises. And I thought she, like, killed the cop. And I was like, holy shit, did she just kill the cop? What's going on? And no, she just ran into the house. So I'm, like, rewinding it. I'm like, so she didn't stab him? It just had a stabbing sound? That's going to be one of our sound effects, is a stabbing sound? And I mean, the telekinesis thing takes a backseat to the jocks, spur posse thing, and it's just why they spend so much time on them.
Yeah,
you know, the first one, Sissy Spacek might be, you know, not very bright because her mother's kept her ignorant, but she knows to go to the library and read about telekinesis. And this one, the kid's like, no, I didn't do that. No, you're lying. I'm gonna be a normal girl.
Right. I don't know. There's not too much more to say about this movie, but one thing that is kind of interesting just about the timing of this movie is that I think it was released – I read this on IMDb. It was like released a month before Columbine happened.
Ooh,
so
okay.
It totally got in under the wire of you know, high school massacre, high schooler on high schooler violence movies.
I wonder if that affected it. No, I guess it didn't.
Yeah, it's just interesting, and it's another thing, you know. In the post, you know, we're way past Columbine now, but also post bullying hysteria, or I guess we're in the midst of bullying hysteria. What that's going to do for a Carrie remake being made now? I mean, you know, in the hands of an intelligent filmmaker, it could be something really profound and great. But you know, I'm not going to hold my breath on that.
It's another female director. It's the lady who made Boys Don't Cry, which is of course a film about violence and bullying too.
Okay, well. I don't know. We'll see.
I mean,
no matter what, it's got to be better than The Rage.
Yeah, and I mean, The Rage actually, it came out at a very interesting time because it was when horror was popular again, thanks to Scream.
Right.
But this is not a Dimension Films release. And I think it's pre-Scary Movie, right? Scary Movie 1 yeah. was 2000.
Yeah.
So it was in the, like, little window between Scream and making fun of Scream.
Which is parodying a parody, you know?
It just goes in a circle and a circle and a circle. I mean, but it's just sort of incompetent. This came out in the theater. $21 million. This cost $21 million in 1999 money. Come on. Like, what is that? You could make, I don't know, shit, something. You could make, like, you know, 19 good movies on that.
Right.
But you would think, and I would love to see where the money went, because how did those terrible CG effects cost anywhere near what this must have cost?
I don't know. It probably, you said it before, it probably was the 3 years of pre-production that they started in 96.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know who could have played the dad? It would have been really funny if Stephen King had done a cameo.
Come here, Sugar Buns. This machine just called me an asshole. Finest moment on screen. Although he is pretty great in Creepshow, too. You ever seen Creepshow?
No.
Oh, my gosh. We should do that like that in Creepshow, too, except that would almost be too much. But, you know, speaking of which, I think this well, maybe we should wrap it up.
Yeah.
On Carrie, too.
I think
we've put in the time. I'm astonished I even had as much to say about it as I did. Considering that I was like falling asleep through it.
It's just coming up with negative adjectives. That's really.
Yeah, but that's what we do. So, you know, we didn't talk about what the next episode is going to be, but I think in our commentary track, the last episode, we were talking about doing Bewitched and I
Married. Oh, yeah.
Bewitched.
Yeah,
so why don't we do that?
Let's do that.
All right, we're going to watch the 1942 Veronica Lake film. Kind of hard to find for one reason or another. I Married a Witch, and which became the basis for the sitcom Bewitched, which got remade into an apparently terrible film with Nicole Kidman and Will Ferrell. And this is going to be the first Will Ferrell movie we've done, and I'm looking forward to talking about why I don't like him, because I think I'm the only person in the world who doesn't like Will Ferrell. So there will be that, and then there will be Veronica Lake and witchcraft, and it'll be just a grand old time. So join us for the next episode, I Married a Witch and Bewitched, and we will see you there. So for an Alan Smithy podcast, this has been Matt.
And this has been Andrew.
And this has been an Alan Smithy podcast. They're all going to laugh at you.